Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all our listeners. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mliwa Gavaza, and for today, it is a Friday, which means we do get into our economics news of the week. Just looking back on some of the top issues in the economy and some of the news highlights that have punctuated the week that has been. And for today, to help us to unpack what's been going on economically, we are joined by Sanisha Pagarasamy, who is an economist at Momentum Investments. Sanisha, good to have you back.
Hi, Mudiba. It's good to be back.
No. Thank you for joining us once again. I think just a good place for us to start is some of the economic indicators that have come out this week. One of the things that that plagued economists over the hard lockdown was getting, you know, access to some of the traditional data points. But as things have been opening up, we've been seeing more and more economic releases. And this week we had the PMI or Purchasing Managers Index coming out, you know, telling us some things. Can you help us to understand what's going on that front?
Sure, Mudiwa. So I think, you know, globally, all economic bodies have struggled to collect data during this time. But as you say, we are starting to find it a bit more easy with looser lockdown regulations in order to start getting survey data once again. In terms of the PMI data that came out this week, the PMI, or the Purchasing Managers Index, is just really a gauge of manufacturing sentiment rather than actual manufacturing activity in the economy. So it is a bit of a lead indicator for what happens in the manufacturing sector. And at the moment, we do have data up until July. And what we saw in the July print is a number that was above the 50 mark level, which generally indicates some expansion is likely in the manufacturing sector. But it does come with a little bit of a health warning, because the way that the PMI is calculated is that it is an indicator of sentiment for July's print relative to June. So that doesn't necessarily mean that output has now suddenly recovered back to pre-lockdown levels. And it is also quite important to look at some of the sub-indices, because they do tend to tell quite a different story if we look at some of the underlyings in a bit more detail. We start off with the business activity index, and this print was quite robust. But remember that the business activity index basically looks at what is happening in the current month in which this is surveyed. We prefer to look at the new sales orders sub-index, and the new sales orders sub-index is a bit more reflective of what future demand is going to look like. And with the new sales orders sub-index looking quite soft, it does reflect a pattern of weak demand that is following out of this lockdown restrictions as we start easing in the economy. Mm-hmm. Again, with the actual manufacturing data, this is only going to be out a bit later. We're going to actually get the May data out on the 11th of August. And if we think back to May, there were still some restrictions that were being applied to certain other manufacturing sectors in the economy. Again, as I said, you know, the sub-indices are quite important of the PMI. On a headline level, on a year-to-date basis, the average PMI looks pretty much the same, like we were sitting in 2019. But if we look at something like employment sub-indices, on a 2019 basis, the average index value would have been 44, so already signaling a number below 50, which indicates that the manufacturing sector wasn't really looking to add many jobs, even back in 2019. But if we look at the 2020 year-to-date sub-index for employment, that number has gone down all the way to 33. So a very, very weak employment outlook. And that comes off quite a poor setting. We know that this index has been below the 50 mark level since the second quarter of 2014. And if we corroborate this with the actual jobs data from Stats SA, we see that manufacturing jobs actually slipped 98,000 since the second quarter of 2014. So at the moment, you know, the manufacturing sector is about 10% of total employment in South Africa. So it is still a significant jobs contributor. But with the outlook looking as bleak as it does in terms of that employment sub-index now, you know, on a year-to-date basis sitting at 33, It does give a bit of an indication that we are unlikely to see massive jobs being created in the manufacturing sector alone. There might be a little bit of a bright spark in terms of the export-related sectors. If I look at the top four export destinations for South Africa, three out of the four had PMI prints that were above 50. So that would have been China, Germany, and the US. The fourth one is India. And of course, we know India, like South Africa, has been plagued by very high levels of COVID-19 infections, and they are not yet out of the woods.
I guess as a follow-up to all the numbers that you're talking about, because it does, you know, sort of paint that picture about, you know, what's going on. And already one of the things I'm picking up is just the fact that what's happening now is sort of more an exacerbation of, you know, some of the trends that were already in place. Do you think, just sort of based on the data that you're looking at, and as you said, it is a lead indicator, but, you know, based on, you know, those things, are we likely to see, especially in the export markets, because there really seems to be a lot of pressure from, you know, places like China, the US, and Europe to really get things, you know, back up again. Could we realistically look at export markets as being that opportunity to sort of offset the lower demand that there is domestically?
You know, I think we need to sort of look at the demand levels that we're likely to see globally versus the demand levels that we're likely to see domestically. And given that South Africa entered the COVID-19 pandemic on very poor economic footing, it does sort of tell the story that South Africa is going to take a much longer period of time to claw its way out of this economic hole relative to some of the other emerging as well as developed markets that were on a stronger economic footing before the COVID-19 pandemic hit. You know, China is quite a good example where they were the first to be hit by the COVID-19 pandemic. And if we look at some of their high frequency data, it appears as though they're one of the first economies to come out of that economic hole. And of course, China is one of South Africa's major trading partners, and that really helps on the export side. So I think, you know, if we look at the difference between export related demand versus domestic demand, I would be a bit more optimistic on the export related demand, because we are anticipating that the globe is likely to recover a lot quicker than our own domestic market is.
And then moving on to another, you know, set of data that came out, this one, you know, piqued my interest quite a bit, was new vehicle sales. You were seeing lower numbers for July, you know, compared to last year, but at the same time, more than June, where sales, you know, were allowed to start again. Any insights on this?
So I think you're quite right. You know, the vehicles sales data should pique some interest. The automotive industry is very economically significant for South Africa. It still accounts for 7% of gross domestic product, and about 14% of our total export market comes from the automotive industry. Now, if we look at the July numbers, that recovery started to fizzle out a bit. So the domestic volumes were actually only up 2% month on month. And then again, sort of speaking back to that export component, the exports were actually up by 31% month on month. So it does suggest that there was more activity taking place at some of our ports, and that could just be an indicator of demand levels starting to recover globally. We did have a very torrid second quarter, however, for vehicle sales. So if we look at the expected full year numbers, we are still likely to be down quite significantly. If we look at the second quarter numbers, I mean, we knew that these numbers were going to be bad because of the COVID-19 disruptions. They were very much in line with the motor industry expectations and really just the experience globally. The aggregate new vehicle sales were down 63% in the second quarter relative to a year ago. That's even bigger than the drop that we saw during the global financial crisis. At the peak of the crisis, in terms of the most negative impact on the vehicle sales market, that really occurred in the first quarter of 2009 during the GFC. And we had vehicle sales dropping by 35%. And as I said, this time around, aggregate sales were actually down 63% in the second quarter. So this is the largest decline on a quarterly basis that we've had on record. NAAMSA puts out in the market their own expectations for the new vehicle sales market, and they do expect better conditions to start recovering for the new vehicle market, as well as the export market. But again, for the year as a whole, we could actually see the market dropping down to levels that we last saw 20 years ago. So what we had in the second quarter is essentially many vehicle manufacturers try and operate on a three-shift basis and multi-shift basis. If you look at the machining, the paint shops, the body shops. However, this was actually paired back to single shift basis or a double shift basis because of the COVID-19 restrictions. So as a result, you actually had capacity utilization in the car assembly line falling quite significantly. So in the second quarter for cars, capacity utilization dropped to 38%, and it was in the upper 70 to 80% previously. And that actually ranged to about 42% for your heavier vehicle sales like trucks. So you can see that capacity utilization, you know, between 38 and 42% for the second quarter of the year was significantly lower than the traditional 70 to 80% that we'd see in previous quarters. And that's really what dampened the output from the vehicle industry in the second quarter. For the year as a whole, NAAMSA expects that total cars will be down by 30% relative to a year ago, and total exports will also be down to the same magnitude of 30%. Going into next year, they expect the level of exports, the number of units being exported, to recover back to 2015 levels. However, that's unlikely to happen in the domestic sales market. So again, speaking to that component of the domestic market taking a lot longer to recover relative to global demand.
You know, as you're talking, I'm just thinking about what the implications are, because on the one hand, the numbers do sort of seem depressing. You know, I also had, you know, brief opportunity to look at, you know, some of the numbers, and, you know, it tells quite a dire story. But as much as vehicle sales are down, there's a part of me that is saying, wow, people actually are still buying cars, you know, because on the one hand, incomes are down. Some people have lost their incomes. Unemployment is has gone up quite significantly in the country. And now, you know, you sort of ask yourself, who's actually buying these vehicles in the export market? I totally understand that the demand factors are different, but domestically, I'm just wondering, like, who is still buying cars? And also, just thinking about as life progresses, what the skew is going to look like between people buying motor vehicle fleets versus people buying personal vehicles. Will people still be, you know, all of those things? Those are just things that come to mind.
Sure. So I think, you know, there has been a bit of a shift in consumer behavior overall. And we have seen this coming out in the consumer confidence indices that are published by the Bureau of Economic Research. So the consumer confidence index fell to lows that we last saw in 1985 on a headline level. But what was more interesting is one of the questions in that survey that they ask is whether this is a good time to be purchasing durable goods. So in other words, your discretionary items like furniture or like cars in this case. And what we saw from that index is that that index fell to its lowest level ever, and by quite a significant margin. So that really indicated to us that consumers are still very wary of going into discretionary spend, and there may be a bit of a shift back into the necessity goods. So who are these people that are buying the cars? I think we also can't, you know, forget that the Reserve Bank has played a significant role in easing policy throughout this COVID-19 pandemic. And since the beginning of the year, they've eased interest rates by more than 300 basis points. And so this has actually lowered the interest cost. And as a result, that could have freed up some cash flow for indebted consumers and could have allowed some consumers to take up additional vehicle financing, even in this kind of torrid economic environment.
No, we'll definitely have to keep an eye on what this one is looking like, for the rest of the year, because there's a whole value chain of people, banks, manufacturers, transport, logistics, etc., that are all relying on this particular sector. But moving on to something that made big headlines last week, the loan to South Africa from the IMF, around the 70 billion rand coming to South Africa. We've gotten some insights into what the terms and conditions are, because that was one of the big mysteries. A lot of people sort of thought the country is likely just going to stick to what Minister Tito Mboweni spoke about in his budget speech, but we weren't 100% sure. What do we know now?
So we do have a bit more information. I think, as you say, Madiwa, there was a little bit of confusion around the nature and the conditionalities associated with this IMF loan. We were one of 35 countries that has been awarded with the Rapid Financing Instrument, which is this form of emergency financing. But the rationale behind the IMF loan, or the RFI, the Rapid Financing Instrument, is that this is emergency funding. This crisis of COVID-19 has no one to blame, so it's not something that the country's governance structures manifested, and as a result, there shouldn't be any conditionalities attached to this type of loan. Usually, you can only get up to 50% of your country's quota of the loan, but given the extent of the damage caused by COVID-19, the IMF relooked at this and actually increased the quota to 100%. So for those 35 countries that were getting the RFI, you could get up to 100% of your quota. In South Africa's case, from the countries that accessed the RFI, we did actually get one of the bigger amounts, and that, as you say, was close to 70 billion rand, or 4.3 billion in US dollars. That in itself adds about 1.5% to our debt to GDP ratio, which the IMF said is not too onerous, over and above the debt levels that we're currently experiencing. Now, in terms of that conditionality, essentially the IMF has said that we can use the money as government wishes, as long as there is a certain level of transparency and basic governance around the funds. And in order to keep us accountable, there is, of course, quarterly reporting on how these funds have in fact been used. So these funds can be used to either fund additional health costs, or they can go towards helping out distressed firms. It can even go towards the top-up social grants that government made available throughout this period of the lockdown. Now, what government has done, and it's almost like a step of goodwill, if you wish, is that they've drafted a letter of intent. But it's very important to note that this letter of intent is self-imposed by government, and it's not something that the IMF said that we have to have in place in order to get this financing. And that letter of intent was signed by, first of all, the Minister of Finance, but it was also signed by the Reserve Bank Governor. And in this letter of intent, they've made the intention to have some sort of debt ceiling. Remember that government already has a self-imposed expenditure ceiling. What they want to impose now is a debt ceiling. And on the monetary policy side, they've suggested that they would like to ensure that inflation doesn't accelerate above the midpoint of the 3% to 6% target band on a sustained basis. In other words, they wouldn't let inflation run above 4.5% for too long a period. And secondly, any of the unorthodox monetary policies that have already been implemented in the COVID-19 pandemic, such as the liquidity management measures or even the regulatory allowances, these would effectively be unwound over time. So that's really the basis of the letter of intent, but it really comes through from the South African government side rather than the IMF dictating. Of course, if we ever do knock on the IMF's door for additional sources of finances, through some sort of program, that would then in fact come with another set of conditionalities and another set of terms and costs.
No, it's a and from that, do you anticipate that this might be the last of the loans that we get? Because just trying to keep count, this seems to be the third loan that we've that as a country we've gotten, starting with the, I think the new the They call it the New Development Bank or the BRICS Bank, that had its, I think it was $1 billion. And then we had the African Development Bank. And then at the same time, now we have IMF. Are we likely to get more of these international loans, or should, you know, could they just, you know, come back to borrowing from the domestic market?
Now, I think there are a couple of things to consider here. One of which is, you know, why do countries approach the IMF for funding? So generally, a country would approach the IMF for funding if they are experiencing something like a balance of payments crisis. So if you have a terms of trade shock, like a commodity price shock, or if there's some exogenous shock like a natural disaster, or if they've got poor fiscal management. So that could imply either that you're spending too excessively. It could include something like too many transfers going to failed state-owned enterprises, like in our case, or simply revenue under collection. Or it could be something like just having bad monetary policy that eventually leads to some sort of loss in revenues or just rampant inflation. Now, for South Africa, we could probably make the case based on poor fiscal management and excessive spending that we could then apply for some sort of additional program or loan. Now, there are a couple of types of arrangements that are available to emerging markets. In the case of South Africa, because we no longer have very strong macro fundamentals, some of these are ruled out. So there are only two real options on the table for us, which include something that they call the SBA, the standby arrangement. And there's another one called the EFF, the extended fund facility. Now, if we look at the standby arrangement as an example, we could potentially get up to 435% of the country's quota. So that would give us quite a big sum of money of around $18 billion. So that would come a very long way in trying to plug the revenue gap that Treasury is currently facing. But of course, with a loan of this nature, there would be some sort of program and conditionality attached to that. So that would imply that government would then have to undergo fiscal austerity in order to be able to satisfy the requirements of that loan. It would mean that we would have to have a relook at the public sector wage bill. We would have to relook at the amount of money that we are doling out to the failing state-owned enterprises. We would really have to beef up administration on the revenue collection side. But these are all positive aspects that I think that the market and financial markets generally would readily digest quite easily. Because it does really force some sort of policy anchor in South Africa, and it forces the government to do the things that are necessary in order to prop up longer term growth. As you said, you know, is this a possibility? Again, this all depends on government willingness and government appetite at the end of the day to take on a loan of such a nature, knowing that there are some conditionalities attached. Particularly, you know, doing structural reform in a country such as ours, there are usually winners and losers. And if we are sitting with a very extended fiscal deficit, it's going to be more and more difficult to try and compensate those losers as we embark on a path of structural reform to improve the longer term growth trajectories.
And then finally, in terms of your outlook for the country, do you see, at least on a macro level, that some of these loans will actually help the country to implement the structural reforms that you're referring to now? Because I think as a country, people have been talking about these reforms for a really long time. And sometimes it feels like there's little movement, if any, on these issues. And they do end up affecting, you know, the everyday person, whether it's, you know, higher unemployment, and more importantly, the corruption. But do you think, you know, just reaching out to an IMF is one of those things that might actually help the country to be a bit more accountable?
So I think it does actually create a firm policy anchor in that respect. It does allow government to embark on structural reforms because they will be at the behest of the IMF and of the fund itself. But, you know, ultimately, the success of IMF programs is very reliant on governments trying to fix the underlying problems in an economy and achieving the targets that are set out on the conditionalities. So again, it all boils down to government willingness and ability to adhere to some of these stringent requirements that comes with something like an IMF program.
So that's been us with Sanisha Pakarasamy, who is an economist at Momentum Investments, just giving us a roundup of the week's top economics news, starting off just talking a little bit around what's been going on in the with the Purchasing Managers Index, which is a lead indicator, just talking about what we might see going forward in terms of the manufacturing sector. One of the issues that she did highlight, which you know, is quite also paints a bit of a negative picture, is when she says, when you look, you know, when you drill down at some of the sub indices and you see that the manufacturing sector is likely to have less hiring going forward. And then we spoke about the vehicle sales and how they, you know, they seem to be down. Very good growth in terms of exports, but on a domestic level, not so much. And then just talking about what's going on in terms of you know, the IMF and the details around some of the conditions that they have. Also ending off talking about how the IMF and its loans might be one of those things, a policy anchor, she calls it, to sort of help the government embark on its reform project and mandate. So yeah, that's it. Thank you so much to Sanisha for joining us for today.
This is Mudiwa's Take.
It's good to see that we are now, you know, having a more steady stream of economic data coming out, sort of helping us to understand and keep a pulse on the economy. The PMI, and we actually had a previous conversation around the PMI, especially how the PMI how the Purchasing Managers Index is actually performing in other African countries, and that painted its own story. And now that we are, you know, sort of getting to see what it's looking like locally, it does show what the actual impact of COVID-19 has been. Some of the sub indices she did mention, especially that employment one, not a good one, but it does highlight, you know, something. I did mention it just now, and it does highlight the fact that and you do see it even in the vehicle sales, that export markets might be a good opportunity for local manufacturers and businesses. We spoke during the weeks of the hard lockdown to the wine industry. And at the time, one of the things that they were fighting for was to be given licenses, even though there was an alcohol ban at the time, to be able to sell their alcohol to export markets. And that might be the way forward for some of the industries, especially the ones that either aren't able to operate or ones that have seen, you know, a big impact in terms of you know, lower demand. So export markets, especially in the countries that are trying by all means to open things up, you know, particularly the US, that might provide a good opportunity for the country to offset the lower domestic demand that, you know, can be expected. People, there's less work at the moment, higher unemployment, and the fact of the matter is everyone is trying to preserve cash. So the things that people are spending, you know, their money on, it does change consumer habits from that point of view. It will be one to keep an eye on, just to see what that PMI and those vehicle sales are looking like at the end of August, at the end of September. And by the time we get to December, what type of picture that data will be painting for us. So that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcast on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab. And then you can also find us on Twitter, where hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your podcasted. Thank you to our amazing team. Our producer is Paige Muller. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.